From the Melanina Zuckerman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona, this is Keeping Up with Public Health Pandemic Response. This episode, we have a conversation with Dr. Nicole Yuan and Dr. Patricia Haynes. Dr. Yuan and Dr. Haynes are both associate professors in the Melanina Zuckerman College of Public Health and licensed psychologists in Arizona. Dr. Yuan's current research interests include adverse life experiences, interpersonal violence, coping and resilience, substance use, tobacco cessation, and community engagement in health promotion. She was a recipient of a K-23 Mentored Patient-Oriented Career Development Award funded by the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism that focused on interpersonal violence and substance use among American Indian tribes. Dr. Haynes' clinical and research expertise is in sleep psychology, depression and anxiety, and intervention research. Her research program investigates how stressful life events affect sleep and daily routine to increase risk for depression, stress-related disorders, and obesity. Dr. Haynes is the principal investigator of the NIH-NHLBI-funded Accessing Daily Activity Patterns Through Occupational Transitions study, examining the impact of job loss on daily lifestyle. Dr. Haynes starts us off with what we know about how disasters affect mental health, and Dr. Yuan gives an example of a possible way stress is manifesting in our society today.
So, what do we know about how disasters impact mental health? Well, we know on an individual level, it creates a massive sense of instability, just in terms of our sense of control over the world and what we know. So it would make sense that when everything that we know has changed and the safety of people that we love and people that we know and worry about is potentially threatened, it makes sense that we would develop reactions of fear or sadness or anger or many different possibilities. We know that disaster can kind of throw things in a bit of internal chaos from an individual perspective.
So I think this podcast is talking about the impacts of COVID-19 on mental health, but we now have a major event going on in our country affecting many cities and states related to George Floyd, who died while in police custody in Minneapolis. And as a result, we've had protests and clashes with police, resulting in looting and violence and many arrests. Thinking about how the pandemic has affected us and our mental health, right, probably has also affected what's going on right now related to responses to George Floyd. But I recently read an article in the New England Journal of Medicine that talked about mental health and COVID-19. And one of the things they said is to think about, you know, what people are experiencing. So the stay-at-home orders, the quarantines, the mixed messaging that we're getting in the media in terms of science, but also policies. It's creating a lot of distress in people's lives on many different levels. There's some interesting research actually about the effects of quarantine. Sometimes people are confusing the terms quarantine and isolation, but quarantine is actually where individuals that think they have been exposed to a virus like COVID-19 are then staying home and restricting their interactions to ensure that they don't get anyone else sick. And the research on, there's a actually just recently a review of 24 studies looking at the impacts of quarantine and found many negative impacts. That includes post-traumatic stress symptoms, depressive and anxiety symptoms, but also a lot of emotional reactions, fear, anger, confusion, irritability, impacts on sleep. There are many different levels of distress. And for some people, this level of distress will become more severe and result in a diagnosable condition, such as anxiety disorders or depressive disorder or actually post-traumatic stress disorder.
Actually, can I just add something real fast? I just want to say that we know that some people may develop clinical disorders, which means that you have a problem with something functioning in your life or significant distress. But we actually know the majority of people do not. You know, from disaster research, one of the things is that we know that the majority of people go through recovery and are highly resilient. So it's actually a very low percentage rate. Just because people might be having really strong, emotionally intense reactions, a lot of it makes sense given what's going on. And that doesn't mean that there's a mental health disorder or a diagnosable problem. One more thing I just like to add is, you know, I think we need to be really careful about saying that COVID is intensifying things, because We don't know that. And frankly, there are plenty of riots before COVID when it came to police and social, with police and social injustice, and lots of differences. So I really don't want to diminish what happened there. And I'm not saying you were doing that, but I think we just need to be careful about attributing certain mass actions or individual actions to exactly what's going on with the pandemic.
Is there anything that is suggested to differentiate between one who self-quarantines and one who a quarantine is imposed on them, either by the government or by their family members? Are the effects of that different?
Yeah, I didn't see in the review article by Samantha Brooks and colleagues kind of looking at that. I do want to, though, point out that one of the things I didn't mention that I think is noteworthy, a few of the studies did long-term evaluations of the impacts on quarantine. The samples were very diverse in terms of population groups. So some studies were with healthcare workers, some included students, some included other community members. I didn't see specifics about whether it was self-imposed or imposed by others. But one thing I think is noteworthy when we're thinking about mental health is that reactions can occur long-term, right? Not just immediately after an experience. And there were at least two studies that looked at the long-term impact of quarantine among healthcare workers and found that they had, in those studies, increased risk of alcohol abuse and dependence. Again, the sample was with healthcare workers. I wasn't able to detect whether it was imposed or not imposed, but there's potential increased risk of substance abuse longer-term after a quarantine experience.
So how, looking at past situations and past quarantines, Dr. Yuan, I like how you differentiated between quarantine and self-isolation because the stay-at-home orders were more of self-isolation. How is the coronavirus pandemic different from these past situations where it's now, you know, countries that are under these social isolation orders, stay-at-home orders?
Okay, so what makes a pandemic unique? So we've already talked about social isolation, and to me, I think one of the first things that typically happens in disasters, if you think about like the fires, the wildfires that happened in California, for instance, last year, is that there was a mass evacuation and then everybody immediately came together to stop and rebuild. That coming together as a group in a community is something called collective efficacy. It's really important in terms of rebuilding the community. And I think what is unique about this pandemic is that it's making it harder. Social isolation is making it harder to come together. That doesn't mean that we can't find unique and creative ways to come together and rebuild, but I think what's unique about the pandemic is that it's harder to find ways to do that.
I think it's also been challenging because, and this was discussed in the article by Perferbam and North, looking at the mental health impacts of COVID-19, is that there's just a lot of mixed information in the news, and there's a lot of different responses. If we look at county responses, state responses, federal responses, and a lot of times it's changing because we are experiencing a virus that we're still learning a lot about. And so that's impacting all this kind of different messaging, but then different entities are making different decisions and different policies. And that's creating a level of distress for individuals and families. And now I think on some level, the reopening is causing maybe not more distress, but a different kind of distress because people are needing to kind of make their own decisions about their level of risk and what they feel comfortable doing leaving their home. I read an interesting article in the New York Times that was talking about, you know, individual risk assessments and what's involved in that, right? Are you thinking about where you're going, how long you're going there, how many people will be there, the people that are there, what potential risks may they have, what risks do you have? So now it's really up to individuals and families to begin to decide what to do. And sometimes that's confusing if you're trying to figure that out. And there's a lot of different information out there to try to interpret to inform your decision making.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of times we call these things social schemas. Whereas, you know, we go into a grocery store, we go into a restaurant, we know what to do. And now oftentimes we really don't. I would agree. Absolutely.
Right. And things that were so commonplace where you didn't even need to think about when you go into a restaurant, what do you do? But now they're saying you shouldn't touch the menus. You shouldn't touch, you know, the tabletop. You should be sure to use plastic silverware. Do you want to be indoors or do you want to sit on the patio? Are you wearing a mask and when are you taking off your mask or leaving it on? Using the public restrooms, things that one didn't need to used to think about or think about whether you were going to make different decisions that were just kind of habitual.
And I would just say that on top of it, there's a couple of things. Absolutely. I think it creates a lot of confusion for people. And then I think we would be remiss if we also didn't talk about ways the pandemic is the same with other disasters. Although the long-term effects might not exactly be the same. But one of the things we know from other disasters, for instance, is that oftentimes, you know, employment is wiped out. We have threats to self and others and people that we care about that can be direct, you know, effects from the disaster, other people. So I think what's been another thing that's kind of unique about this is that we have huge economic impacts and it's sort of like slower and longer term versus one big wave that's hitting. If you think, again, if we go back to the wildfires, which don't get me wrong, those it's a huge giant effect that has long-term consequences, especially if we think about cities that are wiped out, but you can stop and rebuild. Whereas, and you know, you kind of know when the fire's out and you can start the rebuilding process. Whereas here, the exposure is kind of chronic and it kind of keeps coming and going and nobody knows exactly when like safety and the rebuilding time can begin. So I think that's another really like unique part of this giant worldwide stressor that we're going through.
And do you think that with other pandemics, and again, I don't want to diminish other natural disasters or other pandemics, but do you think there are some cases where people have an idea of what life is going to return to once everything kind of levels out? And this, it seems like now that the term new normal is often brought up, do you think that that brings a lot of people discomfort to know that like our social contract in some ways is kind of being rewritten right in front of us? What is going to be the new normal as far as how we go out in public? Do you think people are taking that particularly hard?
I think one thing is that what has been challenging with COVID-19 is that it's impacted our entire country and our entire world. And so it's not isolated to just one area, one group of people, one type of industry, one type of setting. And so a lot of things are being affected at the very same time, right? We have high rates of unemployment. We have schools that are closed from K through 12 to colleges and universities. We have industries that are pretty much shut down and related to the pandemic, and they're all happening at the same time. And there's uncertainty in all of those arenas. So, you know, if it was just related to your workplace and you knew that you have to make adjustments in your work, okay, you know, maybe you find ways to cope with that and make adjustments. But if it's also related to your children's school, and so now you're homeschooling and you're adjusting to working at home, or maybe you're unemployed and you've got children at home, and then, you know, maybe your partner's profession is also affected in a different way and they're having to adjust, and then you're concerned about your elder family members because we have to be thinking about the high risk groups. I mean, it's just on so many different levels. And like Tricia mentioned, it's not going to be resolved quickly. We don't have a very clear roadmap moving forward. I mean, we're hearing of ideas about what recovery will look like, what reopening will look like. But there's still a lot of uncertainty. And I think thinking about just the cumulative impacts is where some of the levels of distress can happen. But again, there are forms of resilience. And I think in any of those areas in one's life, there's ways of adaptation and coping and resilience building. And I think it's the fact that it's happening in all aspects of our lives. So even if you're working with a community and they're being impacted by COVID-19, you're also, as a public health professional, being impacted and trying to adjust. So it's just so many moving parts, I think, makes the current situation very challenging.
Yeah, and I just like to weigh in on a word that you used, which is uncertainty. You know, we look for experts to help us come up with what the new normal is going to be. I've gotten that question a lot, but I think what's really important is experts for us to say we don't know. I mean, our political leaders don't particularly know. And at this point, I think that the more we can come into this sort of acceptance that we don't know what the futures hold, the more we can work right now here to figure out how to run our lives so that we can be productive, successful, and have good mental health strategies. So I think that actually pivots us really well for a discussion on resilience and what we can do in the face of uncertainty and when it's hard to plan in the future. A lot of families right now are talking about schools, what's gonna happen. You know, some states have permission, some don't, and even if they do, they might not. And I think it's really important for people to recognize that nobody has the answer right now. And if we can plan a lot of contingencies, what can I do given that I don't know for sure? As I can still plan, but I can also sit with the fact that those plans might not come to fruition and I need to be adaptable and adopt that flexible mindset so that I can pivot at many different levels. And I would say that is one of the core features that we think of when we talk about resiliency.
Yeah, and I think it's great for us to switch kind of topics to think about what are ways for us to promote our mental health, build resilience, build on strengths, both individual strengths, family strengths, community strengths, and resources. There are many different resources out there, I think, in terms of thinking about resilience and how we deal with this time of uncertainty. One is some people gain a lot of benefits of just being very in the present and relying on certain spirituality and other belief systems that are very much about being in the moment, because that's what we have right now. Right? We don't really know what tomorrow might bring, or a week from now, is how to be in the moment. Sometimes, you know, mindfulness and meditation helps achieve that. Some, you know, Buddhist philosophies, but others too. Anyway, I mean, in terms of coping, it's really based on the individual, what they find helpful. But also, being present-minded can be very beneficial, but also, like Trisha mentioned, about thinking about the future. So it's not like that we shouldn't think about the future. Many people are referring to this as a marathon, right? We are in a marathon. It's going to take a while for us to develop an effective vaccine that can be then shared with communities. So we need to build our resilience for today and be present-minded, but we need to also think about ways that we can build our resilience for this long marathon that we are all in, whether we want it to be or not. And there are a lot of resources in terms of thinking about resilience building as something that helps increase our ability to adapt and pivot moving forward as we learn more about how the pandemic is going to exist in our lives.
Yeah, and maybe this is a good time right now that I really want to mention what we know from the research about the five key ingredients that we need to focus on. And as public health workers, really trying to keep these five ingredients that can promote recovery in the aftermath of short-term trauma. And those five are promoting a sense of safety. So again, you know, thinking about how does this pandemic promote safety, right? And already masks come to mind, but we can talk more about those when we get the five out. The second one is promoting calming. And I would like to talk a lot more about that today if we can. Promoting a sense of self and collective efficacy. So what that means is that sense of mastery in an individual, like what are they doing to make things better? And what are communities doing to make things better? The fourth thing is promoting connectedness. How can we stay connected? Maybe it shouldn't be social isolation. It should just be virtual connection, right? Or other ways. And then finally, five is promoting hope. What can we see looking forward in the future? What can you personally see? So there are five different ways, and public health workers are at the forefront of helping move things in those five ways and promoting them for sure. And I'd be happy to give examples, but I also want to let Nicole weigh in a little bit on some essential ingredients that she also sees in this, or any examples that you would have.
I think those are great. And I think there's a lot of useful tools out there. One, I just want to highlight, because I was teaching a graduate course this semester, and during this pandemic, I obviously wanted to include this topic in the materials, because we were talking about social and cultural and behavioral aspects of public health. But I was also really mindful of the students and how they were experiencing the pandemic. Many of them were living by themselves. They were isolated from their families, and students couldn't come to campus and experience campus life. And one of the resources I found online was actually not a place that I was aware of, but it's called the Watermark Retirement Communities. And they talk about, and you know, there's no research to support their framework of resilience, but What I liked about what they share on their website is they provide a lot of resources. And I think right now a lot of individuals or families are knowing that they need to do something to build up their strengths, but are at a loss of what those resources are. They aren't in touch with professionals or providers that can provide them. So they're having to rely on information online. But I like this Watermark Retirement Community's website, and they talked about four E's, which overlap actually nicely with what Tricia was just talking about. One is related to tend to your essence. So how do you achieve a sense of inner peace? Are there things that can give you a sense of peace right now when there's so much that feels chaotic in your world, that ability to achieve a sense of peace despite what's going on in your environment? So that was one of their E's. They also, another E, which overlaps nicely with Tricia's point, is engage in your community and with loved ones, right? We know that isolation can create distress on different levels. So talking about forms of engagement. One of their E's that I really liked was called enhance your mind and cultivate curiosity. We can be overwhelmed with reading the news and just responding, reacting to the pandemic, and we're responding to changes in our lives. But are there other things that we can do to kind of cater our interests and our intellectual pursuits? And they had a really great list of websites and free programming related to courses, related to science and the arts. Especially a lot of families are home this summer with their children, and there's a lot of great links on their website to free programming through museums and other organizations. And they also talk about embody your healthiest self. And I know, I'm sure Tricia's going to talk a little bit about this, but thinking about our mind and body and how we can promote wellness in all of our areas of ourselves, both our mind in terms of our psychological functioning, but also our physical health in terms of thinking about exercise and diet, but also thinking about sleep, which Tricia has expertise in, spirituality, other areas. So it's great to rely on science, but there are also some really great tools that various entities have been putting together that are easily accessible and don't cost anything to use.
I have a follow-up. One of the four E's, the second one, engage in community. What are some of the higher impact ways that one can engage with community while maintaining social distancing and doing this stuff? Are there some activities that are more impactful on a person's mental health?
We know that community connection is really important. So what does that mean? It can mean a lot of different things for a lot of different people. So for instance, neighborhood communities, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, one of the things we know is there's so many people. I just got a new dog. I go out in the morning, walk my dog really early, and I have gotten to know all my neighbors with dogs because they're all walking. We're staying 6 feet apart, right? And so now we're starting to see meet different types of neighbors, hear about different neighbors that are elderly and might need some help. I have younger kids, school age, like middle school kids. And so my older daughter is another good example of community. She's doing a virtual online free babysitting for her sister and all her sister's friends who are 8 or 9. So I give that an example is that she's now doing virtual online camps that are free for people. Also, you know, several of those people might have some issues with employment, so it's for free. And that's a way of helping community. So it doesn't have to be super complex. We're not sitting here talking about going to different agencies, but it's finding ways that people can come together. And for some people, virtual has given a lot of options. But for some people, unfortunately, we really, as public health workers, need to look for those people that are not connecting, those people that are in their houses that might not have as much access. And that is where we really need to be putting our emphasis and resources right now in terms of that fourth promotion of connectedness. And all of those five things come from one of the key articles in disaster research. If anybody has an inclination to check that out, I highly recommend it. I think it should be required reading for every public health worker. It's the Stefan Hopfall article in 2007 in its consensus guidelines, the five essential elements of immediate and midterm mass trauma intervention, and its empirical evidence. So it's really a group of researchers with a tremendous number of examples of ways to promote recovery in each of those five areas.
And what are some techniques that either public health workers can use for themselves or for their patients?
As public health workers, I think that one of the key things we need to think about is how to promote calming. So I'm going to talk on the individual level for a minute, and then we can kind of go up to family and community level when we talk about that. On an individual level, I'm going to tell you one thing that does not promote calming, which is telling people to be calm or telling people to slow down or kind of getting annoyed with a person. That actually does not promote calming at all. So if we think about the opposite of calming, usually a lot of times people automatically go to fear or anxiety, as people who are really upset or sad or crying. But I also want to mention the idea of anger as being opposite of calming right now too, because I think that is a reaction that we're seeing kind of like all over our country, which is opposite of calming. And so going in when someone's angry, and maybe it's even like a coworker that's angry, anybody who's angry, and saying we need to calm down isn't going to help out. So as public health professionals, we need to kind of think about developing our toolkit on an individual level, again, then ramping up on ways that we can promote calming. And there's a lot of different ways. One of the best ways and the key thing that first responders use, medical health professionals use, is to start slowing down the way that we communicate with people and taking deeper breaths. Because when I start talking slowly, naturally we can kind of engage those mirror neurons and whoever we're interacting with in to talk slower as well and to take deeper breaths. And then suddenly we're promoting calming. Okay. And then once we engage people, we can start to teach and talk skills, coping skills. It's never in the middle of mass trauma is it easy to talk, like teach coping skills, but start encouraging people to use the skills that they already have, that they already possess, to promote, like, what do you do to calm down when you've had difficult situations in the past? Well, I've never had a situation like this. Well, of course you've never had a situation like this. None of us have ever had a situation like this. But in times when you've been through adversity, because I know you've been through adversity before, what have you done to help take care of yourself? And depending upon the person, depending upon the cultural background, depending on whatever, they might be like, well, you know, I've done a lot of, you know, maybe I used to go engage in spiritual worship. Maybe I used to take, I like to exercise. Maybe I actually try to get more sleep and I go to bed a little bit earlier, right? And be like, seemed like you had a really good strategy there. Have you tried that here? So starting to think through ways that we can support people to use their natural skill sets that they already have. Who are we looking for right now? Who are the people that might not? It's those people that maybe didn't have the most healthy skill set to help with that calming. And that, again, is where we need to focus our attention. So many things right now competing for our attention as public health workers, but that is where we need to focus the attention. It's the person who's like, well, I used to calm down by having a 6-pack of beer a night. Or I used to calm down by, you know, whatever unhealthy coping mechanism actually leads to more problems down the line by punching a wall and a hole in the wall, right? So that's where we need to focus our attention and start putting our resources to people who have not particularly developed the healthiest way of promoting calming skills. And we need to put our resources into helping those people find help and find treatment.
Yeah, and I would just like to add to that. I think one of the great points that Tricia made was about helping individuals identify what helps them gain that sense of calm or peace, and that it really can be different for different individuals, different families, different groups. I do a lot of work with the American Indian communities and populations. And for them, a lot of times, not for everybody, but for some, really kind of re-engaging in cultural practices and traditions can improve kind of sense of self and connectedness with their families and their history and their communities. And so I think one of the things we try to be careful in public health is not to impose our ideas on others, recognizing there's so much diversity in every population. Even with American Indians, you can't group them all together. There's over 564 federally recognized tribes, and all of them are distinct and unique. But recognizing more kind of the general kind of tools and strategies and helping elicit from others how they can apply that to themselves and their backgrounds. And that's sometimes really the best asset is for individuals to find, you know, what are things that they know from themselves that benefit them versus us to say, you know, this breathing exercise is really the thing that's going to help you most. Maybe it is true for some, but maybe for somebody else, it might be playing a musical instrument, a traditional musical instrument or something, or engaging in some other cultural practice. So I think that's important, is to recognize. And I love the point of thinking back to other things that have helped you during stressful times. But I think we also know that some of us and some people have the opportunity to learn some new skills and knowledge that might be beneficial in terms of resilience building. I know that Tucson Indian Center has put a number of their classes online, and it's been very, very popular. So, for example, the basket weaving class has been very well received. So maybe it's something, maybe there's something that ties you to your community or your cultural background that you haven't had time to do, but now maybe could do that, and that would give you a sense of calmness and a sense of kind of well-being that might be beneficial right now.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. The whole point of being culturally distinct, recognizing individual and community level differences. I just think that's super important. You know, one other thing that I would like to say about anger is that anger often comes when people feel like things should be different than they are, right? I'll say it again. It comes when people feel like the world or people or things should be acting. So if someone cut me off and I'm driving, that person shouldn't be driving that way, right? So then I get angry, right? So the idea, when we deal with difficult people or difficult coworkers, or we're frustrated ourselves at things that are happening, is stopping and asking ourselves, am I not accepting the reality of the situation as the way it is? Maybe I need to help this person actually just experience that loss. Maybe it's a loss of, you know, if I gave the example of someone cutting me off and driving, because we've all had that little annoyance, right? But maybe I just need to accept that that person is not driving well and I need to back off, you know, instead of telling that person how to drive. Maybe if, you know, if I'm a teenager, for instance, and I don't get a graduation, I'm just angry and I kind of stay in my room and I don't want to engage with anybody because this isn't fair and it shouldn't be this way. Maybe what I need as a parent to just be like, it's really, instead of being like, too bad, get up and go, just to be like, I'm so sorry you missed graduation. That's a loss, right? We all remember our graduations. It's a serious loss. So stopping and kind of acknowledging, it kind of goes with that slow down, calming process. Stopping, slowing down, and acknowledging loss can be a way of potentially intervening on anger. Again, not encouraging people to not experience what they're experiencing, but of helping people recognize sort of the reality of the situation, that it's just not going to be that way. And I'm really sorry.
I love to add on that point, Tricia, because I think one of the things that I have found useful in some of my work on resilience is actually looking at positive psychology, which I know you're familiar with, which and is kind of consistent. I mean, it's beginning to be integrated more in public health, but and it's consistent with public health in terms of trying to move away from a deficit-focused model and more a strengths-based model. We've seen that especially in certain populations. And positive psychology is really the study of what is right about people. So looking at what positive attributes and assets and strengths individuals have, instead of looking at what's wrong in people. And I actually shared a reading about this in my graduate course this semester, and students were extremely responsive. You know, a lot of public health students and professionals don't always, some have a background in psychology and are familiar with, you know, different theories in psychology, but others are less familiar. So positive psychology, my students were extremely responsive. And one of the things that I've really valued is there is a values and action inventory of strengths. And they list 24 character strengths. And some of them overlap with some of our discussion today in terms of hope, right? Courage, bravery, forgiveness. You know, Tricia talked about forgiveness. Someone's done something wrong to you that's angered you. How do you respond? Is there a way to respond in a manner that is more beneficial to your mental health and well-being? So these character strengths, I personally have found them very useful, and they overlapped with some of my research. I've done some qualitative research looking at adverse life experiences and how young adults in the Appalachian region and rural Appalachia have responded some low point experiences. And many of their responses, this is coping that they did on their own, really tied to some of these character strengths of forgiveness, of courage, bravery, perseverance. And I think right now, a lot of us could really benefit on thinking about what are some of our strengths and how can we build on them? How can we help those around us that we care about build on those strengths as well, and putting that into action?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I would say even you're calling character strengths, I call them values, but also just always remembering, just to apply exactly what you said, if somebody cuts me off in the road, other than just, am I going to feel better having forgiveness, or am I going to feel better as a person getting angry and trying to get what I need, right? So finding ways, absolutely, to live that values-based life so that every choice we're having can be values-based. And so how does that relate to public health professionals? Well, not only can we do that in our own work as professionals, but we can also help the people we work with in the communities we work with by identifying those values and acting accordingly. And that is what is key in giving that sense of control and building that sense of collective efficacy so that we can start to rebuild and recover as we face this giant pandemic.
Yeah. And I think it's great because the study that we did and we asked people about their values, for some, it took a little while to think about because it's not something that we think about on a daily basis. What are our kind of core values and what do they mean to us, and how can we act upon them in a way that benefits ourselves, our families, and our communities? And I think, maybe one of the positive ways to look at the current pandemic is to look for these opportunities to reassert our values, our positive values, and to promote them. And again, being very mindful that different individuals and families and communities have different values, and what promotes those values is also very diverse. So again, we can't assume that how you promote courage in one community applies to another community. But again, just having that discussion and encouraging that reflection can be very beneficial, I think.
Great. Well, thank you both. I think that's a great stopping point for us. We want to be respectful of your time. Thank you for the tips and strategies that you presented and the background knowledge.
Well, thanks for this opportunity.
Thank you, guys.